Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Securities Class Actions and Materiality Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 27, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Amgen Incorporated v. Connecticut Retirement Plans and Trust Funds. The question in the case was twofold. First, whether in misrepresentation actions under SEC Rule 10b-5, plaintiffs asserting a fraud on the market theory must prove materiality before they can proceed with the class action. And second, whether the defendants are permitted to present evidence rebutting a fraud on the market theory at the class certification stage. In an opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held by a vote of 6-3 that proof of materiality is not necessary for certification of a class action that seeks damages for violations of the SEC rule, nor did the lower court err in declining to consider rebuttal evidence at the class certification stage. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Breyer, Alito, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined the opinion. Justice Alito filed a concurring opinion. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia in all except parts 1B. To discuss the case, we have Charles Korsmo, who is an assistant professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Korsmo.
This is Charles Korsmo from Case Western Law School, and I'm here to talk about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Amgen v. Connecticut Retirement Plans and Trust Funds. And this is an interesting case, and it's significant in its own right, but perhaps it's even more significant for the rather broad hints several of the justices drop in their opinions regarding an even more important issue that might be addressed in the fairly near future. The court's decision, which I wouldn't say is hugely surprising, clarified that security fraud plaintiffs seeking to invoke the so-called fraud on the market presumption of reliance do not need to prove the materiality of the alleged fraudulent statements at the class certification stage. It's enough for plaintiffs at class cert to properly plead materiality. They don't actually have to prove it. And again, this wasn't a hugely surprising decision. It did resolve a circuit split. The Second Circuit had required materiality class certification, and the Fifth Circuit had done something similar a few years ago. But the case is probably most significant as providing a bit of preview for what's going to be a more fundamental dust-up over the fraud on the market presumption itself on the whole. Arguably, the fraud on the market presumption has led to an explosion of frivolous securities fraud class actions over the past quarter century, and there have long been calls for the Supreme Court to reconsider whether the fraud on the market presumption is a good idea, and I expect this dispute is going to come to a head in the not-too-distant future here, and there's some clues as to how it might come out in Amgen. So in the Amgen case itself, Connecticut retirement plans were alleging that Amgen, the big pharmaceuticals company, made a number of misrepresentations about two of its big blockbuster drugs, and these misrepresentations inflated Amgen's stock price. Then the truth eventually came out, and the stock price plummeted. It dropped by something like 9%, allegedly. So this is a pretty typical securities fraud class action here. And Connecticut Retirement Plans was seeking to certify a class of everyone who bought Amgen stock during the period of the misrepresentations and before the truth came out. So historically, in the absence of any controlling statutory language on how private securities fraud actions should be structured, courts have largely modeled the fraud action on the common law tort of deceit. And one of the things you would have needed to show in a deceit action is that you actually relied on the defendant's misrepresentations. And that poses some difficulties in securities fraud cases in that, first of all, depending on the situation, many investors, or even most investors, won't have actually heard or read the supposedly fraudulent statements. Not everybody plows through a prospectus or the 10-Ks or all of that before buying a stock. More importantly, probably as a procedural matter, though, if every investor actually needed to prove that they heard and relied on the misrepresentation, it would create a huge number of individual issues that you would need to prove at trial, and that would preclude class certification under Rule 23b-3. So the fraud on the market doctrine actually surmounts that barrier to class certification, and the basic idea is pretty simple. Somebody tells a material lie about a company, you know, whether it's misstating your earnings or what have you, analysts, market professionals, arbitrageurs, they're going to hear those lies, and the market price is going to change in response. It's going to rise, for example, or be inflated. And then I come along, I'm your innocent retail investor, and I haven't heard the lies, but I'm just relying on the market price as an unbiased estimate of the true value, and I buy the stock at the inflated price. And then the truth comes out, stock price craters, and I'm injured even though I never read or heard about the lie. So the idea is that public stock markets are just different in this respect from face-to-face markets, you know, a used car lot. In that situation, individual reliance would really be essential to showing causation. With a public stock market, it's not necessarily so. By relying on the distorted market price, which was distorted by the misrepresentation, I've indirectly relied on the misrepresentation itself. So that's the basic idea behind the Supreme Court's adoption of the fraud on the market presumption, which it did 25 years ago in 1988 in Basic v. Levinson. And Basic and the fraud on the market presumption, they really make the 10b-5 class action possible. Without the fraud on the market presumption, individual questions of reliance would virtually always make class certification impossible. But this presumption only really makes sense if you've got a few things. First of all, you need the alleged misrepresentations to be publicly known. They need to be out there where analysts can see them. You need the stock to be traded in what the Basic Court called an open and developed market, what other courts have called simply an efficient market. And you need that to ensure that the alleged misinformation would be quickly, predictably incorporated into the market price. You also, of course, need the plaintiffs to have bought the stock between the time of the misrepresentation and the truth eventually coming out and correcting the misrepresentation. And there's a recent case just a year or two ago, Erica P. John Fund versus Halliburton, where the Supreme Court held that you actually need to establish all of these things at class certification in order to get the benefit of the fraud on the market presumption. Well, arguably, if you need to show those things at class certification, you would actually should need to show something else, too. You should show that the alleged misrepresentation is actually material. After all, if the misinformation isn't material, it wouldn't have any discernible effect on the market price, and the notion of indirect reliance that really underlies the fraud on the market presumption would be inappropriate. It would be severed. And that was essentially Amgen's argument here, that without materiality, the fraud on the market presumption becomes simply incoherent. And as a result, plaintiffs should be actually required to show materiality at the class certification stage in order to get the benefit of the fraud on the market presumption in the first place. That's the argument. Unfortunately for Amgen, a 6-justice majority of the court rejected this argument. Justice Ginsburg ended up drafting the opinion and was joined by a somewhat unusual mix of justices. Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, Breyer, Alito, and Chief Justice Roberts all joined Ginsburg's opinion. And Ginsburg's opinion makes a pretty straightforward argument here. I mean, the relevant issue under Rule 23b-3, governing class certification, is simply whether the claims are susceptible to common proof. And materiality is both an essential element of a 10b-5 claim and an issue that is, at the end of the day, common to the class. Materiality is a common issue. It's not as if the defendant's misrepresentation is going to be material to some investors and immaterial to others. If the misrepresentation is immaterial, it's simply immaterial. And moreover, if the misrepresentation is immaterial, the 10b-5 claim is going to fail. It's going to fail for everybody. The case is over if there's no materiality. And it's over based on common issues, which is all that 23b-3 really requires. Now, if the misrepresentations were immaterial, now that does mean that the fraud on the market presumption of reliance would have been inapplicable, but it doesn't mean that individual questions of reliance are then going to come to the fore and predominate. It just means the case is over. There's no scenario where the plaintiffs would end up having to, or getting to, I should say, litigate individual questions of reliance because of a failure to show materiality. Either the plaintiffs show materiality at trial and reliance can be presumed, or the plaintiffs are going to fail to show materiality at trial and they're all going to lose together. They're not going to litigate the issue of reliance at all at that point. And that's the real difference between materiality and the other fraud on the market requirements the court held in Halliburton needed to be established at the class certification stage. If say the plaintiff couldn't show that the stock traded in an open and developed market, in an efficient market, well, that wouldn't mean the case is over. The plaintiffs would still be able to try to show individual reliance on the misrepresentation. So to be sure that individual issues aren't going to predominate, you need to know whether the market was efficient, and you need to know up front. Materiality, that's just not the case. All requiring a showing of materiality at class cert would do is move the materiality inquiry forward in the litigation. Ginsburg says it would necessitate a mini trial on the issue at the class certification stage. Now, the main dissent, which was drafted by Justice Thomas and joined by Justice Kennedy and Scalia in part, disputes this interpretation. Thomas says that this is really putting the cart before the horse. He argues that if the plaintiffs end up failing to show materiality at trial, that doesn't just mean the claim fails. It also means that the fraud in the market presumption shouldn't have been applied in the first place. The class certification was inappropriate in the first place, but the case really shouldn't have happened. Now, interestingly, while Scalia joined Thomas's dissent in part, he didn't join the essential portion of the dissent that actually made this argument. And he didn't really explain why he didn't join this argument in his own separate dissent. But I think his failure to join it is really a silent acknowledgement that on this narrow 23B3 issue, does materiality need to be shown at class certification in order to be confident that common issues will predominate? That's the narrow issue here. And on that narrow issue, the majority really does have the better of the argument. Scalia describes the majority's reasoning as being logical enough, which by his standards, that's a fairly glowing endorsement, I think, of the opposing side. And I think he's right. If all you care about is whether common issues are going to predominate under 23B3, then showing materiality at class cert just really isn't necessary. So that makes Scalia's other argument in his dissent, I think, a little more interesting and significant. He makes what's essentially a policy argument. If you take the fraud on the market presumption as being written in stone and focus solely on the logic of 23B3, then the majority opinion is probably correct. It's logical enough, as he says. But Scalia doesn't appear to think that the fraud on the market presumption should be treated as being written in stone. First of all, Scalia points out that when we're talking about the fraud on the market presumption, we're talking about judge-made law. The courts created the fraud on the market presumption, not Congress, not the SEC, not anyone else. And he actually might have gone further and pointed out that the entire private right of action under 10b-5 is judge-made law. We're talking about an implied right of action. But the fraud on the market presumption itself, it was adopted by a 4-justice majority in Basic v. Levinson. And the court forthrightly acknowledged in Basic itself that when you're talking about judicial presumptions, they're naturally going to involve questions of fairness, questions of public policy, questions of probability. So if fairness, if public policy, if probability make it seem like a bad idea to apply a presumption of reliance in a certain situation, courts probably shouldn't apply the presumption in that situation. And the really important single salient fact regarding private 10b-5 actions is that class certification is the most important event in the litigation. It's the signal event in the litigation. These things just don't go to trial. They never go to trial. If they haven't settled already, securities fraud actions virtually always settle once a class is certified. Even the small chance of liability is potentially catastrophic. The costs of discovery and trial are so huge that they're potentially ruinous in themselves. So the trials just don't happen. So all of this talk that the majority talks about of showing materiality or showing anything at trial is really kind of fanciful. If the class is certified, there's not going to be a trial. As a practical matter, if the plaintiffs aren't required to show materiality at class certification, well, then they're never going to be required to show it. They're never going to have to show it because there's not going to be a trial. It's going to settle. So the potential here, and really the reality here, of frivolous strike suits is pretty evident here. And if courts are going to use the fraud on the market presumption to give plaintiffs' attorneys a fast track to class certification, and what is ultimately an almost guaranteed settlement, it would actually be nice to know ahead of time that the case is at least somewhat meritorious in that the alleged misrepresentations were actually material. And at the very least, Scalia argues, the court could plausibly interpret Basic as allowing that to be the case, as not requiring a green light to settlement for meritless claims. And if it is susceptible to that interpretation, he thinks the court should give it that interpretation. And actually, I have an article making a similar argument. Unfortunately, it's not cited in Scalia's dissent. I think it's a spectacular example of the clerks falling asleep at the switch. But there you have it. At any rate, Scalia closes with a nice flourish, saying that the majority ends up expanding the consequences of Basic, quote, from the arguably regrettable to the unquestionably disastrous. So what's the major importance of this case? Well, first of all, it makes clear that plaintiffs need only plead materiality to get class certification, so certainly that eases the path to certification for plaintiffs, at least in the Second and probably the Fifth Circuits, although other circuits had already not really required materiality at class cert in the first place. So it's not clear that we're going to see a new wave of frivolous 10b-5 class actions, but it's at least a possibility. The bigger question, though, is the future viability of the fraud on the market presumption itself, and with it, really, the overall viability of the securities fraud class action, which, as I said, simply wouldn't exist in any numbers without it. As the majority was at pains to point out here, and they were evidently relieved to point this out, the parties had not put that issue before the court. Even so, Thomas, Scalia, and Kennedy appear willing to take the opportunity to limit the doctrine and maybe even roll it back a little bit. But the truly important signifier here may be Justice Alito's concurrence. He made a separate concurrence here where he first reemphasized that the fraud on the market presumption itself was not under consideration in this case. But nevertheless, he then goes on to call it into question. He notes that, quote, more recent evidence suggests that the presumption may rest on a faulty economic premise, and concludes that, quote, in light of this development, reconsideration of the basic presumption may be appropriate, end quote. So that, I think, strongly suggests that at least four justices may be willing to reconsider the fraud on the market presumption altogether. And as with so many other things at this point, the future of the securities fraud class action may really lie in the hands of Chief Justice Roberts. So I would look at this issue to resurface in the near future. Again, I'm Charles Korsmo, and I've been talking about Amgen v. Connecticut retirement plans.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.